Good afternoon, Justices, members of the Court. My name is Robert Goff. I represent the appellant in this matter, Alfred Lewis. This case proceeded to trial in Superior Court, and I represented Mr. Lewis at the trial level. Essentially, this is a one-issue, it is a one-issue brief that I presented to this Court, the single issue being whether or not the default rule of Flannery was violated in this particular case. This case, the state's case relied in this attempted murder charge upon the out-of-court taped statements of several witnesses in order to inculpate Mr. Lewis for the shooting of Terrell Loper. None of those witnesses in court identified Mr. Lewis as a possessor of a gun or the shooter of Mr. Loper. However, two of those witnesses in the tape statements did so. At the time of the trial, I will be frank, and I think I said so in my brief, I frankly was not fully cognizant of the rule itself in Flannery. And when Mr. Smith, who was trial counsel as well, brought to the attention that these exhibits, tapes, had to be presented to the court in a certain manner as court exhibits, it frankly was something that was not comprehended by me, and I think, with all due respect to the trial judge at that time, not fully comprehended by him either. During the evening recess, we had the opportunity, I assume, I know the judge because he said so, and I know myself because I did, read the Flannery case and attempt to understand it, what it meant. And I think that the record reflects that Mr. Smith announced to the court an agreement had been made between counsel that these exhibits were to be, these tape statements were to be presented as court exhibits and not played in jury deliberation. That agreement, as Your Honors know, was not accepted by the trial court at that time because there had been a statement made by a juror or members of the jury that as to one witness, Marshall Person, otherwise known as Mann, that they were having some difficulty understanding or hearing his statement.
Now, in that regard, yes, the way I read the briefs, and there were three taped statements, and three of them the jury made no comments on when they were played. Then on this one statement, the juror made a comment while it was being played, and the tape recorder was repositioned or the microphone was repositioned, and the tape continued to be played, and no one said anything about not being able to hear it or understand it.
My review, my recollection, my review of the record, Your Honor, is that is exactly true, and that is the difficulty that comes from the end ruling that the court made in standing by that ruling, as the trial judge said at the second time we broached the subject, when there was discussion by me weighing the circumstances and the reasons why it should not or should come in to jury deliberation, that the court actually said that they were standing by that ruling. But that's the problem with that, that it isn't an individualized analysis that's done. It's done only as to one particular case, and frankly, it doesn't fit neatly into the exception of the Flannery rule to begin with. I think that the reading of that exception in Flannery and other cases indicates that it is often stated that the jury makes the request to hear it, and then at that point in time, the judge decides whether it's appropriate to do that. In this particular case, there is no request by the jury. There's simply a statement of difficulty of hearing. All the evidence and record of this case is that after there was an adjustment made in the volume, that there was no difficulty hearing.
Mr. Goff, yes, if I might, do you read Flannery to just specifically limit itself to the two exceptions that are, as I read the Flannery decision, follows in EG, which means to me, by way of example, that those are not the only limiting exceptions?
Well, Your Honor answered Your Honor's question to a large extent. It is, does say EG, and that's the way I see it as well, except for when other cases have come down the pike after that, for example, the Waterman decision, where there is a rationale that's presented by the trial judge as to why the tape statement should be allowed in, and that is to counteract some statements made during the interrogation of the defendant, that rationale was not accepted by the Supreme, by this court. And at that time in Waterman, I think the quote, I apologize for ruffling through these, the quote was, in Flannery, this court identified two circumstances where it might be appropriate to deviate from the default rule. If the jury requests the tape or if both parties consent, neither were present here, Waterman at 1265. And that seems to indicate, given the trial judge's reasonable articulation of an idea as to why he can exercise his discretion to create another exception, Your Honor, that seems to indicate that it is a very narrow field we're dealing with. And I think that it can't be cut from a general cloth. It has to be applied to the particular case that the court has before it. And the particular case that the court had before it in Alfred Lewis's matter was a case that relied entirely on 3507 statements from witnesses that weren't helpful to the state. And there's nothing wrong with that. That is what 3507 is about. As the trial judge says, this is the classic example of 3507. But that is not the issue before the court, whether this should have come in as 3507. The issue before this court is whether it goes back to the jury room.
Help me understand, yes, how one of the jurors commented that they could not hear a 3507 statement being played. How do we get from that and a focus on that one statement to all of the statements going back to the jury room?
Your Honor, the judge actually refocused that because, as Mr. Smith points out in his brief, the original agreement was just to as to a point in time. But time passed and further witnesses testified. And at later points in time where the judge was articulating the reason why he was standing by his ruling, he referred to all of the statements and he used it in the plural. He also refers to the fact that the witnesses were speaking in the vernacular and it was difficult for him to understand or people to understand generally, not so much the jurors.
Presumably, at least the judge thought that the 1-3507 statement was of poor audible quality. Were they all comparable? I mean, I'm trying to figure out the rationale of the trial judge. Were they all equally inaudible?
They were actually not inaudible at all. You're asking me a question about my perception of it. They weren't inaudible. The folks that spoke, the witnesses, spoke differently than I speak and the judge speaks, and in a different parlance, with different nicknames, with many different street names, not using normal given Christian names, I guess is the way we would refer to it. And as a result, I think that it made it difficult for a person who's not steeped in the culture to understand what was going on. The tapes were not of poor quality at all. They could be heard. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Just two quick questions.
Okay.
Were there contemporaneous objections made to the rulings that would result in those 3507 statements going to the jury?
I've always been trained in oral argument to say I'm glad you asked that question. But that is a difficult question for me to answer. I think that the style in which defense counsel dealt with this issue before the trial court is the style that I'm familiar with this particular trial judge that one deals with.
I mean, the answer is either yes, no, or maybe.
I did not say object each time it was entered in evidence.
Secondly, as to the 1-3507 statement that was either inaudible or had some technical problem, does the record show how long that statement was time-wise? And the reason I ask is because of the follow-up question, and that is, would it have been possible to transcribe that statement and have the transcription sent into the jury room?
I don't recall how long the record, the tape statement was. It was not particularly short. I would say it was anywhere for a half hour to 45 minutes.
At least theoretically, it might have been possible to get it, to have it transcribed for the jury without an undue disruption in the trial.
I would have thought that it would have been appropriate to transcribe it. In my days as a prosecutor, all of them were transcribed, and then I found out that doesn't happen anymore. But that's the way those things seem to happen. But going back to your objection, which is the most troublesome thing, I would think, or one of the more troublesome things from perspective of the appellant's argument, the rule isn't so much that there has to be a contemporaneous objection. The rule is that there must be a specific agreement by the parties. And in this particular case, counsel for the defense did not agree to the process. And as it was discussed throughout, the court, at each time it was discussed before the court whether this would happen, the court brought up further reasons why it was standing by its agreement. At one point, the court says, when an argument is made by me about whether there should be notes taken and the juror should have had notebooks and that would have helped them out a little bit with the situation, the trial judge also then says, well, that seems to indicate that we should probably make that stuff go back so that we can keep that. And then the other thing that happened was the suggestion by the trial court that all of the witnesses in court testimony should be transcribed and presented. So each time defense counsel started discussing this issue, the trial court hardened. And I'm mindful
of... Trial court what?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Trial court what?
Sort
each
of
time defense counsel
hardened its position, or firmed up its position that it wanted the tapes to go back to the jury for deliberation.
Did the trial judge say to you something along the lines of, we can send the transcript of all the witnesses' testimony into the jury room along with the 3507 statements?
That's the implication that I got, and I think he did say that.
And you said no to that?
I said I would think about it. And the problem I had...
That moved the trial along, didn't it?
Well, it didn't stop it because I didn't make that decision.
But which decision?
To order all the transcripts and have them transcribed and presented to the jury.
Let's go back a moment to the point about the objection. At least as I understand Flannery established a default rule. They're not to go back to the jury room. One of the exceptions to that is if defense counsel consents. Why would anyone have to object to a default rule not being in place? And that's anomalous. That makes no sense. You either consent or you don't. If you don't consent, the default rule applies, and they don't go back.
Well, that is the position that I take in this argument, Your Honor. I agree wholeheartedly.
Now, the exception argument is Flannery left room for trial judges in various factual scenarios to depart from the default rule when there was a good rationale for doing so, and one would ultimately assume out of fairness to both sides there will be from time to time some unintended consequences to a bright-line default rule. So there's discretion in the trial judge under certain reasonable circumstances to allow the 3507 statements to go back in the jury room and have to confront the issue of the jury focused on those rather than all of the testimony in toto, which is what Flannery's default rule wanted to avoid. Now, in this case, it gets even more anomalous because there are four statements. Three, nobody has any problem with. One, there seems to, I predict, a factual dispute over whether there's a problem with it or not. But the trial judge let them all go in. It sounds like a trial judge who just doesn't like the Flannery rule.
Well, he didn't like it when I presented it to him, Your Honor, and he didn't follow it and believed that at each point that I raised the issue, and specifically when I indicated that in this particular case it would work a great detriment to Mr. Lewis and would have the most serious consequence that Flannery seeks to avoid, and that is to bring to the fore the evidence of guilt, which was not testified to the court and which was memorialized in tape for them to consider at their leisure as much as they want, and to allow the in-court testimony, which is the staple of our court system, of our judicial system and trial, to allow that to fade from memory.
You made that argument? Made that argument to the trial judge?
I did. I did say that. Probably not as forcefully, because
But that might be read as an objection.
Well, I did object, Your Honor. I have to say, the best way to describe, and out of candor to the court, the best way to describe the manner in which I addressed it on one occasion was as on this hand, on one hand, on the other. It was a little wishy-washy, I have to admit.
But you'd already consented with the other side, only to the extent that they not go in the jury.
Right. But the agreement was, it was the exact opposite situation that Flannery envisions, and that is we had already agreed it was not to come in, and the judge didn't want to hear about it. And I've just been told, we went back to it a couple of times, his position hardened, and at some point in time, it's not a good idea to go back to a judge and keep on asking him to do something that he doesn't want to do, I've been told.
Sometimes it's not a good idea to keep writing opinions telling the trial judges what to do because they don't want to do it.
I'm not in a position where I can agree.
It was a rhetorical statement.
Okay. Very well, Your Honor. But that's essentially my argument. I didn't talk about the harmlessness because it wasn't raised by the state. They didn't argue that if it was error, that there was harmlessness beyond reasonable doubt. So I'm not addressing that here with the court, and it's a simple proposition that I put forward.
So as I understand it, the first time the tape issue came up, the defense and the prosecution said, we don't want the tape going back. And the judge said, your joint position is overruled, the tape's going back. We're, instead of marking it as a court exhibit, we're marking it as a state exhibit. And then three more statements came in, all marked as state exhibits, with the idea that they were all going back.
That's pretty much it.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Deputy Attorney General Gregory Smith on behalf of the state. Your Honor, in Flannery, this court did establish a default rule that would keep out 3507 statements from going back to the jury. But in that same opinion, the court also discussed the broad discretion that the trial court had in admitting such statements as exhibits.
What would you say the trial judge's reason for doing that in this case was? How would you describe the reason?
It was initiated with the Marshall person statement and the difficulty that jurors expressed to the bailiff that was communicated to the court.
But wasn't that solved by repositioning the tape or turning up the volume?
No, Your Honor. I certainly know I tried to reposition the microphone. That improved some things. I think it was a question not just of the volume of the audio, Your Honor, but of the manner in which Mr. Person was speaking on the tape.
Well, let me tell you my concern so that you can address it squarely. And this is a state exhibit, and you would assume the state has the obligation to have a tape that's audible. And the state also knows it has the option of preparing a transcript for the jurors to read along with to the extent it's hard to understand, then the state gets it into evidence. And the problem I see with the exception that the judge invoked in this case is he seems to say it was hard to understand, therefore, we're going to let the jury play it as many times as they want until they do understand it. But shouldn't the evidence come in the first instance in a way that's understandable? I can't imagine that you don't present the evidence, not you, I can't believe evidence is presented in a way that's not understandable. And the remedy is to let the jury focus on that particular evidence as much as they want until they do understand it. Doesn't that emphasize that evidence above all others?
Your Honor, that there is a possibility of that. I believe the tape was fully audible. There wasn't any question in my mind about the quality of the recording and about it when it was being played. I think as counsel represented to the court, Mr. Person spoke in a very animated fashion, used a great deal of slang, and I could understand. Obviously, I had the opportunity to hear the tape numerous times in advance of trial. So I would hope that I was as familiar with that as anyone would have been.
But did he take the stand?
Mr. Person?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor.
Yeah, he would have had to for you to introduce 35-7 unless he was dead, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Did anyone ask him to explain what he said on the tape? Translated into another street's language?
No, Your Honor, I did not ask that question.
Well, if it wasn't inaudible, in other words, it could be heard, but it was troublesome because it was in vernacular or slang, and he was there to explain the slang, why didn't anyone ask him? Anyone proffering his testimony? Did he deny he made the statement at all?
No, Your Honor, he did not deny making the statement.
Well, isn't the logical thing to do to cure the problem is to say, explain what this language means because it's a possibility the jury may not understand your choice of words?
Your Honor, I discussed with him some of his, he had been in a coma after, between the time he'd given the statement and the time that he testified and what his memory was like. I tried to address that.
No, I understand that. And I'm sure his memory may have been affected. He may even be the classic turncoat witness, as was described by your colleague. But he could listen to his own voice. And to the extent he was not understandable because of his word choices, he could be asked on the stand to explain what he said in that sentence in plain English.
Yes, Your Honor, and I'm obviously in an awkward position because I did not advocate to the Superior Court to have these admitted as state's exhibits.
Indeed, you agreed that they wouldn't be.
Yes, Your Honor.
Help me understand, was there a rationale expressed for the introduction of the three 3507 statements that no jury member commented upon?
No, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record to address, distinguish Marshall Person's statement from Linda Mead's, from Terrell Loper, from Demetrius Mayo.
So as to those three statements, was there a violation of the default rule?
If there's no agreement, then yes, Your Honor, there would be.
Can you come up with any explanation as to, even if unarticulated, why the judge was letting it those three statements in other than to ignore Flannery?
Your Honor, they were certainly not purely good exhibits for the state. There was both good and bad in those statements that the witnesses gave. And that was something that defense counsel certainly was aware of.
But the question is, why did the judge let those three statements go back to the jury room in the absence of an agreement?
In the absence of an agreement, Your Honor, from the record, I don't know. I simply don't have a good answer
for
that.
Well, you were there. Is there anything that was said that's not in the record?
Your Honor, this was simply an evolving situation. It seemed like the
and we keep talking about in the absence of an agreement. In fact, there was an agreement. The agreement was that they not go back into the jury room.
Yes, and Your Honor, if I may go through the timeline with the court in some detail, and I please beg the court's indulgence on this.
But when you get done with that, is going to tell us why they went back into the jury room?
I hope to be able to tie it together, yes, Your Honor. I believe that these two things, the redactions of the statements, of the 3507 statements in compliance with Hassan L., were not, they were, those two ideas were certainly tied together during the course of the trial, Flannery and Hassan L., the redacting 3507 statements to take out interpretive narrative. I know that that's not an issue that's before the court, but during the trial, those two rulings by this court on the state had an obligation to deal with were certainly tied together, and so if I may, with that, go back to this timeline.
Before you do that,
yes.
Let me just ask you the same question that I asked opposing counsel. It would have been possible to transcribe all three 3507 statements before the trial. Is that right?
And there were four, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay. And even though that had not been done, once it was apparent that there was a problem with one of those statements, I guess the Marshall statement, it would have been possible, would it not, to have had that statement transcribed in the course of the trial, that is, before the jury retired and deliberated, without unduly disrupting the trial. Is that fair?
I can't say that would have been impossible, Your Honor. It would have been very challenging, but I can't say that it would have been impossible. I was certainly functioning under the impression that the state should not be putting in transcripts under Flannery, that we should have the statement itself is the exhibit.
Well, that's what this court held in Atkins more than 20 years ago, that the best evidence of a recorded 3507 statement is the recording itself, and that a transcript is simply an aid in listening.
Yes, Your Honor, and that then there might be, if the state then transcribes it, then there could be basically a mini trial on, is that transcript now accurate?
But that goes back to my earlier question about it being audible. Everybody agrees this is audible. So if the tape was audible, I assume the court reporter in the courtroom is transcribing the audible tape because it's coming into evidence.
No, Your Honor.
The court reporter did not take down the tape as it was playing, as she would a witness's or he would a witness's statement?
No, Your Honor. I think that's probably, if I can speak globally on this point, one of the kind of common complaints with 3507 statements is they're not transcribed by the court reporter. And that's why when we submit our briefs, we just have to say, we have to cite to something that says tape played rather than a transcript taken down by, you know, this objective court reporter to say what was in the statement.
There used to be a common practice, I'm tempted to say, both when the trial judge was the prosecutor and when I was, that when the 3507 tape was being played, there was a transcript prepared with 12 copies, and the jury was handed the transcript to follow along with the tape, as Justice Holland described, in aid of understanding the tape. They were then at the conclusion of the tape. The bailiff took them from the jury, and they never went back in the jury room. I take it from what you've said, that's no longer the practice.
Correct, Your Honor. I've never encountered that, obviously, in my more limited trial experience, but certainly
more recent, anyway.
Yeah, yes, Your Honor. But no, I have not seen that.
Is that budget-driven? I mean, has a decision been made not to do that anymore for financial reasons?
I truly don't know. I know that I would, I guess speaking from at least the appellate standpoint of the office, I know I would love to see those transcribed as a matter of course.
Mr. Smith,
yes.
On a different topic, in your answering brief, you say by the conclusion of the trial, Lewis's counsel had agreed to the entry of the 3507 statements. Where is that agreement?
Okay. May I sort of address that at the end and try to go through the timeline with the court. I'm sorry. So the second day of trial, December 9th, my co-counsel moved the admission of Lyndon Mead's 3507 statement as a state exhibit. Later on the second day of trial, I moved the admission of Marshall Person's 3507 statement as a court exhibit. During the playing of Mr. Person's statement, a juror informed the bailiff that there were difficulties understanding it. Then later that day, Superior Court directed counsel to confer regarding the status of the exhibits.
I tell you, when you say understanding, we should interpret that to mean not difficulty hearing it, but difficulty understanding.
I'm sorry. Yes. Yes, Your Honor. Then later on December 1st, still the second day of trial, at that point, all the parties agreed that the 3507 statements would all be admitted as state's exhibits. Then day three of the trial, December 2nd, that's when defense counsel indicated that he had reread Flannery, and then we did agree that they would come, the 3507 statements would be entered as court's exhibits. So there had been a change. Then later on day three of the trial, December 2nd, Superior Court indicated that it had reread Flannery. And then it gave a tentative ruling that the 3507 statements should be admitted as state's exhibits.
With a rationale on the record?
At that time, not. Make sure I don't think the rationale is particularly articulated at that time, because that's at A54 of the appendix.
No, not particularly articulated. Does that mean nothing was said about it, or it was as inaudible as the tape, or it wasn't understandable? What does that mean?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't want to get it wrong. The Superior Court said the court appreciated the disfavor with which this court viewed having 3507 statements taken back into the jury room, and then it also recognized that in Flannery that rule was not absolute, and talked about the exceptions, and then articulated that this would be a case where when the presentation of a 3507 statement could not entirely be heard, and with the court having heard and the statement for itself, and with the limitations of that statement, that this would be an exception to the default rule.
And that's what prompted my earlier question. What is the logic behind permitting the jury to go through a trial and not hear the evidence when it should be presented, and then allowing them on their own to play it over and over again until they can hear it? To me, that is a very confusing rule. It seems that if it's going to come into evidence, it should come into evidence so everyone can hear it while everybody's in the courtroom, including the jury. So what is the logic of what the Superior Court said about this evidence couldn't be understood, we're just going to keep going, give it to the jury, and let them keep playing it over until they can't understand it?
I think if that's where the Superior Court's analysis ended, the logic of that is not immediately obvious to me, Your Honor. So let me take you through with what else I can add to that reasoning, because that was only a tentative ruling. It was not the court's final ruling. Then on December 3rd, the fourth day of the trial, the Superior Court revisited the issue and announced that because of the juror's expression in the Marshall Person tape, and now that it had heard all of the statements for itself, it determined this to be an appropriate exception to the default rule. And
well, then, that goes back to the questions from other members of the court. Someone said, we can't hear the tape. Something was done. And no one voiced any concern about whatever the adjustment was. So one reading the record would think whatever led to the concern had been resolved by the adjustment.
Yes, Your Honor, I cannot say that that would be an unfair reading.
Do you have a cite for the final ruling of the court on day four?
Yes, Your Honor. That's going to be at B20 and B21, the state's appendix. That's when Superior Court revisited the issue, and at that time, that's when defense counsel stated that he had not made a decision one way or another. And with Your Honor, I thought then that there wasn't a problem. That's why I thought there was an agreement. If my understanding of what was going on at that moment in time is incorrect, I apologize, Your Honor, but I truly believe then, based on what took place there, that there was not any objection from defense counsel to the having these 3507 statements go back as state's exhibits.
Well, what was the ruling you referred to on B21 and 22?
I'm sorry. And the manuscript is 194. I'll just read from the Superior Court's opinion, so I'm not paraphrasing. Anyway, I think we've worked that out, and I suppose it raises one last time. I'm standing by the ruling that the court has made, I think now repeatedly in the past, Mr. Goff, that Flannery and the other cases of 3507 notwithstanding, they allow for an exception to the rule, and this case falls squarely within that exception, in that the jury, having expressed an inability to hear the 3507 statement, and reasonably so, the court having looked at the statements as well, and the risk of unfair prejudice because of overemphasis of one piece of evidence against another, is, I still think, outweighed by the need for the jury to be able to actually work through the statement to find out what was said. And the court will give a cautionary instruction.
But that appears to address a single statement, which, because there was only one statement that the jury said they could, did they say couldn't hear or could not understand? Is there a difference?
Certainly there is a difference in my mind between can't hear and can't understand. I don't have a good answer for the court on that.
Or indication from this quotation anyway is that there is no rationale given for the other three 3507 statements that were admitted.
Not for the other three, Your Honor, and that's why I was functioning under the impression that there was some sort of agreement at this point.
Well, but the court, in that ruling that you just read, is not letting that one statement go back based on an agreement. He says specifically to Mr. Goff, I'm standing by my ruling. He doesn't say, thank you for agreeing, that solves all the problems because now I'm in the second Flannery exception.
Yes, Your Honor.
He would have had difficulty doing that, wouldn't he, since the only agreement he would have known about was the agreement that they be admitted as court exhibits and not go into the jury room?
That was the most recent in time agreement,
what
yes.
What did he mean when you read verbatim from what he said? What did he mean when he said he had looked at the statements? What was there to look at?
Your Honor, I don't believe when the initial discussion of whether it should be a court exhibit or a state exhibit was going on, at that time, the court hadn't seen or heard all the exhibits for itself.
What you would have seen is a tape.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did Did he mean he'd looked at it in that he had considered the significance of it? He didn't mean he looked at a transcript, because we know there wasn't one, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
So what he would have looked at would have been a tape recorder at a tape, and he would have heard the tape.
Yes, it was audio and video recorded, Your Honor.
Video?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. That's what he meant by looked at it. Okay.
Yes, they were. These were statements in a Wilmington police interview room.
So all four of them were videos?
Yes, Your Honor. All four were both audio and video. And then obviously, Your Honor, the Superior Court did give defense counsel the opportunity to submit transcripts of the in-court testimony, and defense counsel did not accept that offer from Superior Court.
Why would defense counsel want to make sure the jury understood that his client was implicated by the 3507 statements, and if they didn't clearly see it on the video, they could read it in the transcript?
Your Honor, I believe that would go to why some of the redactions were left in, that defense counsel asked to not have as much redacted as the state initially offered, because there...
By redactions, you're talking about editing the video?
Correct, Your Honor. Because there, as I said before, the statements are not entirely favorable to the state. There were... And I believe defense counsel was able to argue that the individuals who were making those statements were just trying to help themselves out, for lack of a better phrase.
Is it correct that the state's evidence virtually in its entirety were the 3507 statements?
As long as we're talking about the attempted murder part of this case, yes, Your Honor, certainly... There was lots of other evidence that didn't go to the attempted murder charge. I see that I'm almost out of time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Please, Court, I will not spend very much time at all speaking. I know that there was a question as to why transcripts aren't written anymore. I have a little bit more history than Mr. Smith does in the trial court, and I understand that the police agencies don't produce the transcripts anymore, and that is the reason why it isn't presented. So I just let the court know that as a point of information.
Why isn't it a fair inference? Mr. Smith says that when we were looking at this part of the transcript of the judge's final ruling, that he believed there is an agreement. Why isn't that a fair inference on this record, that there was an agreement for these, all of these 3507 statements to go back to the jury?
Because Mr. Smith has tied together, he used that phrase, he said that the defense, and it's fair to tie together the defense's position that it agreed on the redactions, which were much less than what had originally been proposed by the state, in cognizance of Hassan L. and Huggins and all those cases. And that, I don't think, is a fair characterization. I think that the reason those things are tied together is because in the state's brief, they tied them together. The argument, which extends to more than half of the state's argument throughout its brief, is about Hassan L. and about the defense's...
The redactions relate to what the jury hears. It's
correct.
A separate issue as to what goes back to the jury room. Why isn't it a fair inference that there is an agreement that all four go back to the jury room?
Because I didn't make that agreement. I didn't object continuously after the court repeatedly made the same rulings. Each time I tried to discuss the issue of the Flannery rule. At some point in time, as I mentioned earlier, I stopped. But I don't think that the contemporaneous objection
that Justice Jacobs mentioned in his question is necessary for the defense to prevail or the appellant to prevail in this matter because of what Chief Justice Steele said about the default rule being that there has to be an agreement. So if it means that I didn't...
Unless, of course, the failure to object can reasonably be construed as some sort of assent.
I can't disagree with that.
Which might be rather difficult if you'd already entered into an agreement with the state that they not go back in the jury room.
Once again, just Chief Justice, I agree with you on that subject. Anyway, I don't want to beat this too much more, so if the court doesn't have any more questions, I'm...
Okay, thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.